Welcome to New World Notes, ably hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. This installment, number 154, marks our third anniversary, and I thank you for your support. During this third year, we finally got around to the subject of food and agriculture. We did two shows on the subject this fall. There we focused on the systemic structural problems of our now globalized agribusiness system, and how the system causes hunger worldwide. Today I want to focus less on the big picture and more on a handful of the system's bizarre results right here in the, quote, homeland, unquote. So we'll be hearing about topics including the nuttiest consumer product since Pet Rocks, which is bottled water, about why the poorest people in America are the fattest, and about the organic carrot from hell, which in fact I own. The carrot, that is, not hell. I hope you'll stay tuned. The carrot story. At the supermarket, I bought a sealed plastic bag of peeled organic baby carrots, so-called. All firm and bright orange and crunchy. I washed a handful and served them with dinner. Except one that I washed sat on the counter and forgot about. I discovered it the next afternoon. It was a dull orange-gray color with an odd white coating, about half of its former size, and about as flexible as a dried apricot. The next day, the magic carrot was dark gray, smaller still, and even more flexible. It looked like a very old piece of licorice, or something I scooped out of the cat box. This is an organic carrot? This is a carrot? Meanwhile, back inside their plastic bag, its unwashed cousins were firm and orange and looking as though they were fresh. This wasn't a kitchen, this was a vegetable horror movie. What was that magic elixir of life that I had washed off the carrot? Embalming fluid? No mention of preservatives on the package. I'm not sure what the moral of the story is. Apart from the connection between American food and nature seems to have gotten pretty tenuous. Let's take a look at another example with a clip from the documentary film Food Inc. First, a little background. American corn production is heavily subsidized by your tax dollars. Corn is turned into sugars, and corn is fed to cattle. Because of the corn subsidies, prices of junk food, soda pop, and meat are very low in America, well below the price of fresh fruits, vegetables, and dairy products. The lower classes and the poor buy what food they can afford, so their diets are very high in junk food, soda pop, and fast food hamburgers. Consequently, the poorer you are, the more likely you are to be obese, and the more likely you are to suffer from diabetes. Both conditions have life-threatening consequences. Let's hear a segment of Food Inc. called The Dollar Meal. The Gonzalez family stops at the drive-thru window of the Burger King. Mr. Gonzalez, at the wheel, orders dinner for the family of four. The rodeo cheeseburgers and the chicken sandwiches are only a dollar apiece. The bill comes to $11.48. They eat the meal in the car as they drive. Mr. and Mrs. Gonzalez and their six-year-old daughter are all decidedly overweight, and Mr. Gonzalez is diabetic. The teenage daughter is of normal weight. Each rodeo cheeseburger sandwich contains 19 grams of fat, according to Wikipedia.
I want a dollar meal, five rodeos.
Five rodeos?
Cheeseburger.
Okay.
Two chicken sandwiches. Two small drinks, and give me a large Dr. Pepper.
$11.48.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We didn't even think about a healthy eating because we used to think everything was healthy.
Thank you. You too. Thank you very much. Eva.
Now that I know that the food is really unhealthy for us, I feel guilty giving it to my kids. But we don't have time to cook because we leave at 6. We don't get home until 9, 10 at night.
when you have only a dollar to spend and you have two kids to feed, either you go to the market and try to find something that's cheap, or just go straight through a drive-through and get two small hamburgers for them. And okay, here, eat them. This is what's going to fill her up, not that one single item at the market.
The Gonzalez's are shopping at the supermarket. Broccoli sells for $1.29 a pound. The six-year-old wants some Bartlett pears, but they're too expensive. At 99 cents a pound, that's 50 cents a piece.
Look at the broccoli. It's too expensive, man.
What did you want to eat, then? First, check to see how many are there for a pound.
Okay.
Not worth it.
Why not?
You'd only get like two or three.
No, come on. Ah.
You can find candy that's cheaper. You can find chips that are cheaper. The sodas are really cheap. Sometimes you look at a vegetable and say, okay, well, we can get two hamburgers over here for the same amount of price.
Investigative journalist Michael Pollan.
Why is it that you can buy a double cheeseburger at McDonald's for 99 cents and you can't even get a head of broccoli for 99 cents? We've skewed our food system to the bad calories, and it's not an accident. I mean, the reason that those calories are cheaper is because those are the ones we're heavily subsidizing. And this is directly tied to the kind of agriculture that we're practicing and the kind of farm policies we have. All those snack food calories are the ones that come from the commodity crops, from the wheat, from the corn, and from the soybeans. By making those calories really cheap, that's one of the reasons that the biggest predictor of obesity is income level. Over the course of human history, we were struggling to make sure we had enough food and enough calories for a sizable percentage of the human race now. The problem is too many calories. The industry blames obesity on a crisis of personal responsibility. But when you're engineering foods, you're pressing our evolutionary buttons. I mean, the fact is we're hardwired to go for three tastes: salt, fat, and sugar. These things are very rare in nature. Now sugar is, you know, available 24/7 in tremendous quantities. We're eating hundreds of pounds of the stuff a year. This diet of high fructose corn syrup and refined carbohydrates leads to these spikes of insulin and gradually a wearing down of the system by which our body metabolizes sugar.
My husband's diabetic. One of my main concerns is he can lose his sight. He does get into sometimes his shaking, so I'm afraid that he's going to start not being able to drive, because that's what he does for a profession. We have to consider his medicine. What is it, $70?
50 pills cost him about $130.
But he's on two different types of pills, 100 and something for one pill, and then 100 and something for another. That takes a lot of our income away. We're really tight from either paying for his medicine to be healthy or buying vegetables to be healthy. So which one should we do?
The elder Gonzalez girl and 20 other teenagers sit in a circle in a teen health advocacy group in their high school. The topic is diabetes. The disease is linked to high sugar intake and to obesity.
It's hard to see my dad suffering with diabetes and stuff like that. And it's really sad to see that probably my sister might have it.
There's something that's going on in the way that we live our lives and where we play and where we buy our food and the types of food that we're able to buy that is causing this epidemic. And it's not just our community. It's not just Baldwin Park. It's everywhere. How many of us know one person in our family with diabetes?
Almost everybody raises his or her hand.
How about two?
Most hands stay up.
Three? Keep your hand.
Most hands stay up.
It used to be that type 2 diabetes only affected adults, and now it's affecting children at epidemic proportions.
One in three Americans born after 2000 will contract early onset diabetes. Among minorities, the rate will be one in two. And I neglected to mention earlier, the Burger King Rodeo Cheeseburger Sandwich has not only 19 grams of fat, but also 9 grams of sugar. McDonald's Big Mac has very similar numbers. So if your doctor has put you on a high-fat, high-sugar diet, either product would serve you well. Now, not to knock Burger King, but if your doctor also wants you to increase the amount of calories, cholesterol, and salt you consume, then I'm afraid Big Mac is the hands-down winner, with 540 calories, 80 milligrams of cholesterol, and more than a full gram of sodium. However, the Big Mac costs considerably more than a dollar. So, in terms of nutrition per penny, two Rodeo Burgers may be your wisest consumer choice. This is nutrition expert Kenneth Doust reminding you that your body needs a certain amount of calories, fat, salt, sugar, cholesterol, and our own special sauce. On New World Notes, we're looking at some of the oddball particular manifestations of government agricultural policy and corporate-controlled globalized agribusiness. This week, we're not talking about serious hunger, though there's plenty of that even in this country, but of bizarre effects, such as millions of obese diabetic children, of poor people being much fatter than rich people. Henry VIII would have had trouble wrapping his head around that one. About allegedly organic carrots that I suspect would ignite in a shower of sparks if you so much as looked at them cross-eyed. Coming up, an expensive beverage that is inferior to its almost free competitor, and an ecological disaster to boot. But first, a bit of local color. New England fishing villages, where they no longer do any fishing. I know what you're thinking. The perfect counterpart to factory towns where they don't have any factories, like Detroit. Well, yes. Here's a condensed version of an AP story by Jay Lindsay from last August. Fishing legacy fades in New England ports. Dateline, Plymouth, Mass. Mike Secondo remembers the days when Plymouth's docks outshone its rock. Tourists swarmed the town pier in the 1970s and 80s, snapping pictures and bantering with commercial fishermen as they unloaded another shimmering haul. Secondo is convinced tourists went home remembering the fishermen more than Plymouth Rock. "You couldn't move," he said. "The tourists were in awe of what they were looking at, the fish, the boats." Today, Plymouth's fishermen are all but gone. Last year, according to federal statistics, Plymouth had zero landings of groundfish. Groundfish is a general category that includes cod, haddock, flounder, and good stuff like that. Tough new laws enacted in May have fishermen at New England's ports worried that their history will fade away as fishermen, faced with low catch limits, sail out to larger interests. It's already happening in the smaller ports, slowly changing the character of the New England coast. Ground fishing historically has employed large numbers in good jobs. The romance of the deep-sea pursuit of finfish is embedded in a region where its most famous cape is named after its most famous fish, the cod. People don't want that way of life to become just a memory. Is it progress to switch from a waterfront that produces food to a waterfront that hosts cocktail parties? Asks Warren Doty, a selectman in Chilmark on Martha's Vineyard. There, fishermen are struggling to preserve a working waterfront on Menemsha Harbor. A recent analysis indicates how densely the Northeast industry has consolidated around the major ports, New Bedford, Gloucester, or Boston. Meanwhile, federal statistics show ground fishing has withered or vanished in numerous small and mid-sized ports in the last 30 years. Rockland in mid-coast Maine landed 16 million pounds of groundfish 3 decades ago, but none last year. Jerry Carvalho says fishing boats once jammed city docks in Newport, Rhode Island, where he's fished for 3 decades. Now Newport is a tourist town that sells its beauty and Gilded Age history, but almost no fish. The city went from 14 million pounds of groundfish in 1980 to a scant 37,000 pounds in 2009. In 1995, Marblehead, Mass. Landed 500,000 pounds of groundfish. South Bristol, Maine landed 870,000, and Harwich Port on Cape Cod, 1.2 million. The total for each port this year was zero. Fishermen say the industry's deterioration was caused by onerous regulations, which they say was pushed by environmentalists and based on flawed science that badly underestimated fish stocks. Sidebar comment, this is what technically is known as a bunch of hooey. Back to the text. Environmentalists point to a legacy of overfishing enabled by poorly conceived rules that set too many boats loose on too few fish and devastated fish stocks. All right, enough local color, or local loss of color. Let's move on from the sorrow and the pity to the ridiculous and the indefensible. Remember Annie Leonard? She produced that fine video documentary, The Story of Stuff, which we played on this program many moons ago. She's back with a newer, shorter documentary, The Story of Bottled Water. Let's have a listen.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. One of the problems with trying to use less stuff is that sometimes we feel like we really need it. What if you live in a city like, say, Cleveland, and you want a glass of water? Are you going to take your chances and get it from the city tap? Or should you reach for a bottle of water that comes from the pristine rainforest of Fiji? Well, Fiji brand water thought the answer to this question was obvious, so they built a whole ad campaign around it. It turned out to be one of the dumbest moves in advertising history. You see, the city of Cleveland didn't like being the butt of Fiji's jokes, so they did some tests, and guess what? These tests showed a glass of Fiji water is lower quality, it loses taste tests against Cleveland tap, and costs thousands of times more. This story is typical of what happens when you test bottled water against tap water. Is it cleaner? Sometimes, sometimes not. In many ways, bottled water is less regulated than tap. Is it tastier? In taste tests across the country, people consistently choose tap over bottled water. These bottled water companies say they're just meeting consumer demand. But who would demand a less sustainable, less tasty, way more expensive product, especially when you can get for almost free in your kitchen? Bottled water costs about 2,000 times more than tap water. Can you imagine paying 2,000 times the price of anything else? How about a $10,000 sandwich? Yet people in the U.S. buy more than 500 million bottles of water every week. That is enough to circle the globe more than 5 times. How did this come to be? Well, it all goes back to how our materials economy works, and one of its key drivers, which is known as manufactured demand. If companies want to keep growing, they have to keep selling more and more stuff. In the 1970s, giant soft drink companies got worried as they saw their growth projections starting to level off. There's only so much soda a person can drink. Plus, it wouldn't be long before people began realizing soda is not that healthy and turned back to, gasp, drinking tap water. Well, the companies found their next big idea in a silly designer product that most people laughed off as a passing yuppie fad. Water is free, people said back then. What will they sell us next? Air? So how do you get people to buy this fringe product? Simple. You manufacture demand. How do you do that? Well, imagine you're in charge of a bottled water company. Since people aren't lining up to trade their hard-earned money for your unnecessary product, you make them feel scared and insecure if they don't have it. And that's exactly what the bottled water industry did. One of their first marketing tactics was to scare people about tap water with ads like Fiji's Cleveland campaign. When we're done, one tap water executive said, tap water will be relegated to showers and washing dishes. Next, you hide the reality of your product behind images of pure fantasy. Have you ever noticed how bottled water tries to seduce us with pictures of mountain streams and pristine nature? But guess where a third of all bottled water in the U.S. actually comes from? The tap. Pepsi's Aquafina and Coke's Dasani are two of the many brands that are really filtered tap water. But the pristine nature lie goes much deeper. In a recent full-page ad, Nestle said, "Bottled water is the most environmentally responsible consumer product in the world." What? They are trashing the environment all along the product's life cycle. Exactly how is that environmentally responsible? The problems start here with extraction and production, where oil is used to make water bottles. Each year, making the plastic water bottles used in the U.S. takes enough oil and energy to fuel a million cars. All that energy spent to make the bottle, even more to ship it around the planet, and then we drink it in about 2 minutes? That brings us to the big problem at the other end of the life cycle, disposal. What happens to all these bottles when we're done? 80% end up in landfills, where they will sit for thousands of years, or in incinerators, where they are burned, releasing toxic pollution. The rest gets collected for recycling. I was curious about where the plastic bottles that I put in the recycling bins go. I found out that shiploads were being sent to India, so I went there. I will never forget riding over a hill outside Madras, where I came face to face with a mountain of plastic bottles from California. Now, real recycling would turn these bottles back into bottles. But that wasn't what was happening here. Instead, these bottles were slated to be downcycled, which means turning them into lower quality products that would just be chucked later. The parts that couldn't be downcycled were thrown away there, shipped all the way to India just to be dumped in someone else's backyard. If bottled water companies want to use mountains on their labels, it would be more accurate to show one of these mountains of plastic waste. Scaring us, seducing us, and misleading us. These strategies are all core parts of manufacturing demand. Once they've manufactured all this demand, creating a new multi-billion dollar market, they defend it by beating out the competition. But in this case, the competition is our basic human right to clean, safe drinking water. Pepsi's vice chairman publicly said, "The biggest enemy is tap water. They want us to think it's dirty and bottled water is the best alternative." In many places, public water is polluted, thanks to polluting industries like the plastic bottle industry. And these bottled water guys are all too happy to offer their expensive solutions, which keep us hooked on their products. It is time we took back the tap. That starts with making a personal commitment to not buy or drink bottled water unless the water in your community is truly unhealthy. Yes, it takes a bit of foresight to grab a reusable bottle on the way out, but I think we can handle it. Then take the next step. Join a campaign that's working for real solutions, like demanding investment in clean tap water for all. In the U.S., tap water is underfunded by $24 billion, partly because people believe drinking water only comes from a bottle. Around the world, 1 billion people don't have access to clean water right now. Yet cities all over are spending millions of dollars to deal with all the plastic bottles we throw out. What if that money was spent improving our water systems, or better yet, preventing pollution to begin with? There are many more things we can do to solve this problem. Lobby your city officials to bring back drinking fountains. Work to ban the purchase of bottled water by your school, your organization, or entire city. This is a huge opportunity for millions of people to wake up and protect our wallets, our health, and the planet. The good news is it's already started. Bottled water sales have begun to drop while business is booming for safe, refillable water bottles. Yay! Restaurants are proudly serving tap, and people are choosing to pocket the hundreds or thousands of dollars they would otherwise be wasting on bottled water. Carrying bottled water is on its way to being as cool as smoking while pregnant. We know better now. The bottled water industry is getting worried because the jig is up. We are not buying into their manufactured demand anymore. We will choose our own demands, thank you very much, and we are demanding clean, safe water for all.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to my best friend in all of Bangladesh, Robin Upton, for finding the story of bottled water. Robin produces the two-hour weekly public affairs radio program, Unwelcome Guests, www.unwelcomeguests.net, and you'll find a link thence, or is it a link thither? In any case, you'll find a link to it on our own site, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. It'll get to my non-carborundum, keep the faith, baby, and let's go out on a bit of Robert Earl Keane. Ciao.
Truth is all I'm looking for, town to town and door to door. Happiness is nothing more than Sunday at the zoo. Riding high inside the wires is some all of my desires. Earth and rain, all it requires is love for me and you, farm fresh onions. You to know there's never none, there's no need.